not to address and was not supposed to address unreported opinions. Four of the consistent opinions are unreported. And maybe I'm mistaken on that. All of them have...
Let's talk about Judge Bew then. Let's just talk about the L.A. Case. Why do you rationalize? He's a good judge. He says the Securities Act exempts it. What do you say? I'm just trying to get a feel for it.
Well, Your Honor was in the legislature. In fact, there's a number of members of this court that were. I never have been in there. I don't know whether or not the legislature responds to a federal district interlocutory court and whether or not that indicates their desire to continue to cause the DTPA to be exempted from the Securities Act. Let me just make this observation. After Judge Sterling made his ruling in Ailes, the DTPA was amended in the cumulative remedy section.
Which one was it that you wrote?
Judge, I don't know. That was one of the unreported ones.
That's one of the unreported. The reported and again, case then is Sterling's case?
Yes, sir. That was the Ailes case. You got to appreciate that. You know, I don't know why Judge Sterling did what he did. He says, notwithstanding the savings of existing remedies, I'm just not going to apply. Now, it was an interlocutory case. It was not appealed. And that's probably the reason, never mind, I won't go that far, but I would suggest that might be the reason that you haven't had other state court cases on it, because they've been scared off by the opinion. In this particular case, the facts fit so perfectly within the purview of the DTPA. It was just, they fit so perfectly that it just seemed appropriate to pursue the matter through the DTPA. Let me just deal very briefly with the second of the arguments that's advanced by Hutton, talking about why the Youngbloods were not consumers. Counsel didn't mention this in opening, I assume he will, when he closes. They take the Knight case and attempt to reverse it. In Knight, there was the holding by Judge Pope that if you had a credit transaction that was intertwined with the ultimate purchase of a good, that could be covered by the DTPA. Well, what Hutton would like to do is say, well, if the service is intertwined with an intangible out here or something that's not a good, then by under the rationale of Knight, you're not covered. They've got two problems with that. Number one is that the statute itself covers services alone. If you don't have anything at the end of the tunnel but a service, it's covered. It says goods or services. Secondly, the court is bound by the liberal construction mandate of the 1744, which means that you should give the broadest construction, not the narrowest. To buy their argument, this court must put words of limitation into 1745-4. You must say that the legislature really meant to add the words, unless the service is intertwined with an intangible. And that's simply not what the legislature has said. There, in the brief, there are 9 or 10 examples.
What is 1745-2 is definition of services. What's 1745-4?
Definition of consumer.
Okay.
And it says, means an individual partnership corporation who seeks or acquires for the purchase or lease any goods or services. And my point is that if you buy their argument, you must add the words, unless the service is intertwined with an intangible, which is not what the legislature said. Let me, with great trepidation, step into this field of attorney speak. I feel somewhat concerned about this because I feel like the only thing I can say in my own defense was that it was in 1984 before we had the benefit of Judge Kilgarlin's article on this and before we had Gatex. And I don't like to come before this court appearing to have this problem that I've got in this particular case. Let me start from an academic standpoint. It seems to me it would be unfair to do what Hutton has asked you to do, and that is to render. They say you should disregard the attorney's fees and render. Now, you must understand, at the time that Judge Onion made his discretionary ruling to allow the attorney's fees issues, had he done something else, said, I'm not going to do that, there were other remedies available. Continuance, non-suit, mistrial. If you render, those remedies are taken away. That doesn't seem fair to me. Having said that in my defense so that if it gets sent back, I have an opportunity to present them, let me address the merits of the issue. I've heard Justice Kilgarlin's expert talk in this area. The court is aware that there's conflicts in this area. I think Gatex does not focus on what this court should focus on. Good cause has never, ever been defined. It's not defined in the St. Mary's Law Journal, and there's no guidance as to what good cause is. If good cause is defined as anything other than an observation of whether or not the other side, the opponent, has been damaged by the late disclosure, I suggest that's not in the best interest of the trial practice of this state. Now, in this case, we had pled for attorney's fees since day one. Mr. Golston, an excellent attorney, when you read the record, you will find he did a marvelous job. I mean, to get a 40% negligence finding against a guy that did nothing but believe his client, he did an excellent job. And he was kind enough to testify honestly and accurately, yes, I knew you would have to use attorney's fees, expert testimony, if you wanted it. And no, he didn't say this, but no, I didn't press you because I knew you had made a mistake. I knew you were going to have to testify, and I was going to prohibit you from coming forward with your expert testimony. And I compliment him on coming up with that, and I feel ashamed of myself for having had to argue this point before the court. The only salvation is that maybe some law and guidance in this area can be given to other trial practitioners, because it's a problem. My point is this. Mr. Golston was not hampered in his cross-examination of me or the other experts. He knew it was coming. Mr. Golston was not hampered in his opportunity to rebut. Rule number one says that the rule should be applied in such a fashion as to do substantial justice. If you just say, was there disclosure or was there not disclosure, and you define good cause on the basis of the fact that is there some excuse beyond the control of the attorney why this was not disclosed, then I suggest that when you make that rule, you need to think about it, because the same rule will apply 29 days before trial as it will 2 days into trial. It seems to me that what the proponent of good cause should be required to show is, number one, that it's not gamesmanship. I mean, he's not out there trying to hide the ball. Number two, that his opponent is not being materially hampered in his cross-examination or in his rebuttal. And then, if the trial judge, in his discretion, finds that the proponent has met that burden, then good cause should exist for allowing the late designation. I think that this court will make a mistake if you go simply on the mechanical, if it's not done 30 days before, no matter what else, unless it's beyond the control of the advocate, that there will not be allowed this witness. The second harshest sanction available will be applied. You will be denied your witness. And what will happen is, trial judges, to avoid that, will start giving continuances, and you're going to have, I mean, that's the way ultimately it will be dealt with. If a trial judge thinks you ought to be able to have your expert, and you're not within 30 days, he's going to give you some more time. And I just don't think that's a good remedy unless the other side can really demonstrate, hey, we're being hurt by this. I appreciate your kind attention, and particularly with reference to the last point that I made.
I'd like to address the attorney's fees issue first. Mr. Bashar has asked that the court should remand the case and not reverse and render. But I think that if this court is to remand the case, it'll show a clear dictate to lawyers around the state that if they fail to identify themselves or other counsel that they have retained as experts, that the Court of Appeals will merely, if the case is appealed, remand the case back to the trial court to prove up their attorney's fees.
Counsel, how are you harmed by this issue, by the circumstance?
Well, let me give you an example. There was potential harm, Your Honor, in that the amount of attorney's fees in this case almost met the amount of actual damages. And it's not in the interest of this profession or the public for the issue of attorney's fees or reasonableness or necessity of those fees or services to be anything less than a full adversarial confrontation. We were harmed inasmuch as the testimony of Mr. Doyle Copney, the expert on the attorney's fees issue, was admitted into evidence, and his identity was never given to Hutton except on the day of trial or maybe a day before, and Hutton did not have the opportunity to counterbalance that with our own expert on attorney's fees.
And that he chose not to.
Well, it shouldn't. The burden shouldn't be on the party who's not at fault under Rule 166B to have to go out and hire an expert in a day's time in order to meet, to show up for trial in order to counterbalance the reasonableness and necessity opinion given by the plaintiff's attorney and his expert, even though that expert wasn't identified. Now,
how do you handle the argument? I'm not sure it was in Madison versus Modern Exploration or one other case, but that on attorney's fees allegation, you know there's got to be proof. And this was the reasoning of one court of appeals reason. I don't remember the style offhand. And therefore, knowing that there's going to have to be proof on that point, you can be prepared to combat it. How do you handle that argument, whether you know the exact identity of the expert or not?
Well, certainly the attorney should be prepared to combat at least the proof put on by a party's attorney if he is intending to prove up his attorney's fees through himself. But in cases such as this, and there are many cases out there where the attorney's fees will meet or exceed the actual damages at issue, shouldn't the policy of this court be that the offer of proof on attorney's fees should be adversarial in nature? And shouldn't we require in those types of cases, if the other side is to put on an expert, a quote, impartial attorney on the issue of attorney's fees, that that person should be identified at least 30 days before trial under Rule 166B so that Hutton or the other side has the opportunity at least to counterbalance that opinion before the jury with hiring their own expert?
Of course, you're preaching to the choir when you're talking to me on that point, but I have colleagues on this court.
let me address the alternative suggested by counsel for the Youngbloods. First, that somehow there needs to be some proof that there was no gamesmanship involved or concealment of the identity of the expert. But I would suggest that really puts the burden upon the party who hasn't violated Rule 166B to prove that the failure to identify the expert was not intentional. And I don't think that that's a just result. Also, the offer to depose and maybe even have a motion for continuance really doesn't amount to an adequate enforcement of Rule 166B, and that it effectively eliminates the sanction because in fact may even lead to an abuse of the rule, and that some attorneys at the last minute, not having taken notice of the Supreme Court's dictates, will simply move for a continuance in an offer of deposition, and that certainly isn't in the interest of expediting the trial dockets.
Counsel, I can't articulate very well a difference, but it seems to me, just from been in the courtroom a lot, that there's a difference in some witness that you produce to prove attorney's fees and one that might have to do with the merits or substance of the case or of the defense. Is there any kind of distinction that you might suggest between those two type witnesses? For example, I could assume that he would have brought any one of 500 lawyers to that courtroom. They would have given us exactly the same testimony about the attorney's fees.
That
none of one of them would be a surprise in any way, shape, or form to the opposing counsel. Is there any way we can distinguish between those two circumstances?
The distinction is really only a matter of degree, in that there may be an actual controversy with respect to the reasonableness or necessity of certain fees. And I can't really think of an example, but if by chance the fees are way out of line in a particular case and are not justified, and one side puts on an expert attorney or attorney to testify to the reasonableness of those fees, and he is not identified, at least the other side, who is in compliance with the rule, should have the opportunity to have his own impartial expert attorney testify that those fees are not reasonable instead of trying to prove up the unreasonableness of certain fees simply by cross-examination. That's very hard to do before a jury, in that the jury is only hearing your questions and not the opinions of another expert.
Are you suggesting that you would have wanted to take the deposition of the attorney that's going to testify about attorney's fees so you can prepare a rebuttal witness? To my knowledge, I don't ever know that that's been done. Has it ever?
I have never done that. I
doubt if anyone has. I'm just looking for kind of a rule that we can make different circumstances.
But I have had other attorneys testify with respect to reasonableness of fees, and their opinions may differ on either side. And so I really think the distinction is one of degree as opposed to quality of the expert testimony. So I don't think that we can separate attorney's fees or put attorneys outside the scope of the rule.
Then in essence, you kind of agree with the rule that you must show some harm, since it is just a matter of degree.
You must show some good cause, but I don't think the good cause was shown in this case.
Well, you're saying he must show good cause.
He must show good cause.
But I'm saying that your answer suggests that, conversely, you must show harm.
I don't think that the rule intends to put the burden upon the party who has not violated the rule to show that the culpable party who has not identified the witness has somehow concealed the identity. I think it shifts the burden of proof there, and I don't think the rule contemplates that.
Would you address, Mr. Bashir's point that the judge found good cause for overruling your objection, in effect?
Yes, Your Honor. The Morrow versus HEB case was decided after the judge found good cause. And two of the reasons why he found good cause, one, that there was a lack of surprise. Two, there was an offer to...
I thought in Morrow versus HEB, the trial judge refused to allow the testimony of the unidentified expert. But the Court of Appeals reversed the trial judge, and we reversed the Court of Appeals.
That's correct. Maybe I made a mistake.
Anyway, Mr. Bashir made the point that the trial judge looked at the totality of the circumstances, overruled your objection, thereby failed to admit the testimony. And I just want to get your comments on that.
Well, I don't think that there was any affirmative showing in the evidence of good cause. There was an offer to depose, and there was an offer to take a continuance until the next day. But under the dictates of the Morrow ATB case, simply lack of surprise or an offer to depose or give a continuance does not suffice to constitute good cause to allow that testimony to be admitted. If I could address a couple of the points on the other issues in the case, counsel for the Youngbloods noted that there's really no difference between a stockbroker who makes an incorrect statement or misrepresentation and a real estate agent or an insurance agent. And I would point out to the court that both real property is included in the definition of goods under the DTPA, and insurance agents are subject to the provisions of the DTPA under the legislative intent, and that is evidenced by the cross-referenced provisions in which it states in the Act that a violation of Section 21.21 of the Insurance Code constitutes a violation of the DTPA, and there is no such cross-referencing with respect to the Blue Sky Law. Now, let me address the question posed by Justice Kilgarland earlier, and that is, if an attorney had given this incorrect opinion, have we, by giving incorrect opinions, or maybe even opinions in which there is room for argument, violated the DTPA? And I think the clear answer is not, unless we make some sort of misrepresentation which might subject us to coverage under the Act. In both of the cases cited by Mr. Bashara, DeBakey versus Skaggs and Lucas versus Nesbitt, there was unconscionable action on the part of the attorney. And I'm not going to suggest that attorneys should not be covered under the Act. I think they should. But in Lucas versus Nesbitt, there was a clear misrepresentation. In effect, the attorney lied to his client by telling the client that he had perfected an appeal. In fact, he had not. And in DeBakey versus Staggs, the issue was presented under the unconscionable conduct laundry list item as opposed to the misrepresentation, and in fact it was gross negligence.
Counsel, I want to be sure now that I understand where you're going. Are you claiming that securities are just exempt, period, from the DCPA, or are you saying, yes, they can be included if you show misrepresentation or unconscionable action? Which horse are you riding?
I'm riding a horse that indicates that the misstatements in connection with the sale of securities are exempt from the DCPA on the basis of the legislative acts, which I have explained today. Under the theory that the legislature met in 1977 and passed the due diligence defense to Article 581.33, that legislative enactment was never intended to be meaningless, and if this court holds that this misstatement made in connection with the sale of a security was covered under the DPA, the strict liability concepts, then in fact, Article 581.33 and the due diligence defense will have been made meaningless.
Why can't you still use due diligence as a defense?
Because under the DTPA, due diligence would not be a defense. All that would need to be proved is the misrepresentation and producing cause. In every other cause of action under the federal securities laws and state securities laws, there is some element or defense which gives the broker essentially a defense in the event that he exercises reasonable care.
What is the notice letter under the DTPA in the record? Did E.F. Hutton receive from Mr. Youngblood a notice that said we're going to sue him under the DCPA? I assume it is.
Your Honor, I don't know. That's not a point that we have contested.
I know it isn't. I just wonder if it's in the record so we can see what to ask for. You make some point in the brief that if you have a DCPA applicable to securities, that they won't have any way to undo it. They're misdeed like you would in most transactions. I couldn't follow that. Why couldn't they unwrap it or unscramble it just simply by paying the $30,000 back or whatever it is?
Well, in hindsight, I think we should have paid the $30,000 back on the basis of negligence. But I don't think that the mere fact in this case that there was negligence found by the jury, that the court should construe that negligence in and of itself to be a misrepresentation.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Counselor. We're going to take a short break.
To assume that there is an amount, not to instruct the amount, not to instruct a dollar amount, but an amount. And that's the end result and the bottom point of why we believe the Court of Civil Appeals opinion is incorrect. Because we have never stated, and the court has never stated, that an amount had anything to do with entitlement to an amount.
Counsel, let me see if we put it another way. If you show that there was, in fact, a loss, then a presumption arises that the plaintiffs were entitled to damages.
Yes, Your Honor.
There's a presumption of damages if you show the loss.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then it becomes the duty of the defendant to rebut the presumption of damages. And you're saying in this case there was no evidence to rebut that presumption of damages.
That's right, Your Honor. And in this case, as in the Ross case, as the court said there, the defendant brought no expert evidence. They brought no refutation of the evidence. There was no questions asked concerning the evidence. And that a finding contrary to that, to the finding that there is an amount of damages, would be incorrect. And therefore, the only question remains, as they say in the court's opinion, the only question remains as to an amount. And I don't say, and I wouldn't put before this court, that the jury was instructed, or we would have a right to instruct the jury that you have to find just what we say. They did find just what we said. The respondent says in his brief that what it did was it opened up the door so that plaintiffs could argue to the jury that they must find that the jury has been instructed and they must find a certain amount of money. I didn't argue that, and the record shows that I didn't argue that. The fact is the jury didn't find the amount of money we pled for, didn't find the amount of money the economist showed, and did find on an independent basis the amount of money that they wrote in for the damages. The rights of the plaintiff were presented, and the liability questions were presented before the jury and the court, and the jury found on the liability questions. I have no idea when they decided those liability questions, Your Honor. I really don't. I don't think anybody does from the record. Whether they decided them or went back and changed them and hit us with another little more percent or a little less percent or whatever. But they found liability, and that equaled the entitlement. The only question we had with the issues was that they was asked to an amount, to find an amount. And they found an amount, which was the right of the plaintiff. For those reasons and for the reasons stated in the brief, we ask that the opinion of the Court of Civil Appeals be reversed, the opinion of the trial court stand, and the judgment go for the petitioner. I thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take a 10-minute recess.
Yeah,
there was a suit pending, there is a suit pending in the district court at this time, as far as I know, involving the identical claims. Actually, there are three questions in this lawsuit. One is whether or not the statutory probate court had jurisdiction of the wrongful death case. Second is whether or not the statutory probate court has concurrent jurisdiction with the district court over the personal injury action, which survived the death of Mr. C. And the third is whether or not it has exclusive jurisdiction of the personal injury action, which survived. We say that as to the first question, the subject of Mrs. C.'s application, on which this, the writ was granted, the Court of Appeals correctly held without any question that the claim for wrongful death is not an asset of the estate or a suit to determine the nature, extent, or status of property that is a potential asset of the estate, and therefore that the probate court, statutory or otherwise, has no jurisdiction to entertain a suit for wrongful death. The beneficiaries are statutory. The estate is not a beneficiary. True, if they don't act within a certain period of time, the administrator or executive may bring the suit, but it's for the benefit of the statutory beneficiaries, and it is not a part of the estate. And I have really little else I can say, but that the Court of Appeals and the Probate Court both correctly held that the Probate Court lacked jurisdiction over the wrongful death action. questions were asked about the effects of the difference in the trial. It's a case now tried before a jury of 12 in the district court. The issues are issues which are not issues of probate courts. They're issues of negligence, of strict liability, if we have it, damages for death, and that sort of thing, which are not probate matters. So therefore, we get to the second question, which is raised by our application, namely whether or not the Court of Appeals was correct in holding that the administration of the pending estate gave the statutory probate court exclusive jurisdiction of the cause of action for personal injuries to the exclusion of the district court. And that there be no question, let me read from the decision of the probate of the Court of Appeals. Thus, where an administration is pending, any matter which is incident to the estate shall be brought in the statutory probate court and cannot be brought in the district court because probate court number 2 of Dallas County had probate jurisdiction in opening the administration of the decedent's estate. It now has jurisdiction to hear all incident claims. Looking to the history of Section 5A of the probate court, I think is helpful in determining exactly what the legislature had in mind when it adopted it. Back when I first started practicing law, we had a county court in Dallas County. That court had probate jurisdiction. At the same time, the Constitution in Article 5, Section 8 provided for a district court as a court of general jurisdiction in all civil suits where the matter in controversy exceeded $500 or was in the amount of $500 exclusive of interest. As the Constitution of 1876 was drawn, the district court had no jurisdiction of probate matters but did have appellate jurisdiction and general control in probate matters. These constitutional provisions were carried forward in Article 1906, setting forth the jurisdiction of the district courts. In 1907, the legislature created the first county court of law for Dallas County, and the statute, Article 1970-1, specifically provided that the county court of Dallas County would retain the general jurisdiction of a probate court. It was not until 1951 that the first probate court of Dallas County was created, giving it the general jurisdiction of a probate court concurrent with the jurisdiction of the county court in such matters and proceedings. In 1963, this court, probate court number 2 of Dallas County, was created, and by the terms of the legislation, the county court of Dallas County retained probate jurisdiction. Therefore, by 1965, Dallas County had 2 statutory probate courts with judges trained in the law and fully capable of handling probate matters. However, this, as was mentioned, was not true of all counties, and in 1973, to remedy the situation of untrained persons elected as county, and I should say persons untrained in law, elected as county judges, trying probate matters, the legislation proposed and the people of the state adopted an amendment to Article 5, Section 8, enacting an entirely new paragraph. And if one will look at the amended article, it is interesting that it retains the same 2 paragraphs having to do with the criminal jurisdiction of a district court, the civil jurisdiction of a district court, and then added a 3rd paragraph having to do with the probate jurisdiction of a district court. The amendment adopted in 1973 includes language: the legislature, however, shall have the power by local or general law to increase, diminish, or eliminate the jurisdiction of either the district court or the county court in probate matters. And I thought it was interesting that Mr. Wilson said whether or not it's a probate matter is no longer the test. Well, I submit to you that it is the test. That is the only authority that the legislature had to tamper with the jurisdiction of the district court, and that was in probate matters. And the Constitution does not define what is a probate matter. But at that time, the time we got to the Constitution, we had Section 3, double small b, of the probate code, which did define probate matter, and defined it as, well, it said probate matter, probate proceedings, proceedings in probate, and proceedings for probate are synonymous and include a matter or proceeding relating to guardianship, as well as a matter or proceeding relating to the estate of a decedent and proceedings regarding incompetence. And that then was the authority of the legislature to amend to limit the jurisdiction of district courts, namely it was limited to probate matters.
Then it comes to
the language which the Court of Appeals and petitioner find so important, being the language of the 1979 amendments found in Section 5A of the Section 5A of the Probate Code, and Justice Kilgallen asked whether it was a may or must. The language is may. The language says all statutory courts may, in the exercise of their jurisdiction, notwithstanding any other provision of this code, hear all suits, actions, and applications filed against or on behalf of any guardians and so on, including the state administration. Then it includes the language, in situations where the jurisdiction of a statutory probate court is concurrent with that of a district court, any cause of action appertaining to a state or incident to an estate shall be brought in a statutory probate court rather than in the district court. If one reads all of the things which are described as being appertaining to an estate or incident to an estate, it's still not very clear whether that includes a cause of action for personal injuries or for wrongful death. But I submit to you that because of the limitations on the ability of the legislature to amend, the limitations imposed by this constitutional amendment, it must be limited to probate matters and not to redefining the general jurisdiction of a district court to hear personal injury lawsuits. I would call your attention to the fact that the caption of the 1979 Act is, and I'm quoting the entire thing, an act relating to the clarification, revision, and amendment of the Texas Probate Code and the amendment of certain other statutes that relate to probate and payments on behalf of minors. Doesn't say a word about diminishing or increasing the general jurisdiction of district courts to hear suits for wrongful death, which don't involve probate, or suits for personal injuries, where the only connection is that the suit is brought by the administrator and will be part of the estate. Suits which are traditionally within the jurisdiction of the district court. And I've looked at the legislative history of the bill. It was House Bill 329 in the 66th legislature, and apparently no thought was farther from their minds when they adopted this. They say nothing about diminishing the general jurisdiction of the district court. It's obvious that what this bill, Section 5A, was designed to do was that where we had the situation of the Mr. Wilson mentions Harrison County, so obviously no probate court as such, so that under the Constitution, Article 5, Section 8, suits in probate are brought in the district court. The district court has jurisdiction of probate matters there. Now, where you have, in counties where you have a statutory probate court, and they are limited in number, Section 5A says the statutory probate court will have this jurisdiction and of probate matters, and where it has concurrent jurisdiction of the district court, the suits will be filed or handled in the statutory probate court. But that's all it does. It's just going back to put into the statutory probate court and remove from the district court jurisdiction of probate matters. Not to say to the district court, you no longer will try a large number of wrongful death suits and suits for personal injury which happen to survive the death of insured. The lead questions arise. What happens if the injured party is alive at the time the suit is filed? And he files suit for himself. And then while it's pending, he dies from his injuries or from some other cause, and his estate is put into probate. Under the Court of Appeals decision, now all of a sudden the statutory probate court in Dallas County has exclusive jurisdiction of that suit
and it somehow, and I don't know the machinery, somehow it's going to have to be transferred from the district court to the probate court. Or does the district court dismiss it now for want of jurisdiction? But they say, well, we had jurisdiction, but we now dismiss it because the plaintiff has died, and although his cause of action survives, nevertheless, it's within the exclusive jurisdiction of the probate court. I don't think the legislature ever intended any such thing. And yet that's the effect of what the Court of Appeals has held. What about, raise horrible situations as a way of arguing, and sometimes it's valid. What about where venue is changed from the county that has a statutory probate court to one that doesn't, or vice versa? A suit filed in district court in Rockwall County, and venue should have been in Dallas County. So the suit is transferred to Dallas. Can the district court of Rockwall County transfer a case to a probate court in Dallas County? Or vice versa? I don't think so. I don't think we have any machinery for that. What happens to the suit where the plaintiff is killed in an automobile accident or injured? I say the plaintiff, the decedent, is injured. And there are three other people in the car with him. They're all injured. We talk about multiplicity of suits. Can a district court in Dallas County entertain a suit for injuries to all four, or must three of them file in district court, and the one who dies, his suit be filed in probate court? I don't think the legislature ever intended that. I think all the legislature ever intended was to simplify matters where there was no probate, no court specializing in probate, no statutory probate court. Then matters could be handled in the district court where we had a statutory probate court. Then probate matters would be handled exclusively or as much exclusively as possible in the probate court and not in the district court. Not that the probate courts have now become courts of general jurisdiction and try all matter of personal injury cases, wrongful death cases, and so on. I don't think the courts are equipped for it. I don't think the judges are equipped for it. A man elected as a probate judge is normally a probate lawyer and not a personal injury lawyer, and he's not equipped for that.
You've been talking about legislative intent, and the amicus brief filed by Jake Johnson, Glenn Land, Slyke, and Wayne Fisher, they have an appendix setting out certain quotes by Representative Kane of late Dallas County, if I'm not mistaken.
I believe you.
Where he talks about the purpose of the bill is so that ancillary lawsuits may be tried in probate court. From your knowledge of the legislative history, is there anything more specific than the language ancillary lawsuits?
I don't believe so. And I think by ancillary, court please, they mean the kind of suit raised in English against Cobb, where it was being contended by the executor that the decedent's sister had converted a savings account. I can very well see that as being ancillary to the probate. It's not a personal injury suit. It involves property which is or should be part of the decedent's estate, and the executor can litigate that in the probate court. The nature of that cause of action is far different from the nature of the causes of action asserted by Mrs. C. in this case.
Mr. Kendall, did you check any of the legislative background, committee hearing record, et cetera, on 73 amendments?
No, Your Honor. I must apologize. I've had to file a very short while, and I have not had that opportunity, although the young lawyer in Dallas who handled this, who wrote the brief, did advise me that he had checked the legislative history, but I cannot tell you that I...
I'm not sure about it. West end of the Capitol, but on the east end, they started recording committee hearings in 73. And I do have some specific recollection that a couple of the probate judges who were pushing this amendment, their contention was that the probate judge should be permitted to try any type of lawsuit personal injury or what have you. I just wondered, I realize that legislative intent is one of the great myths of the law, but there might be some information in those recorded minutes in regard to that.
I have not listened to them. That's about all I have to say. I think the legislative intent has, first of all, I think that the Constitution did not authorize the legislature to take from the district courts their jurisdiction over either wrongful death or personal injury actions which survive. And I have found, I haven't read them, but I haven't found in what I have read any evidence of legislative intent. In the bill analyses, both in the House and in the Senate, there just is no mention of this sort of thing. And I would suggest that if this had been the intention of the legislature, there would have been a great fiscal impact, because all of a sudden we would have found the probate courts in these few counties trying a vastly increased number of lawsuits of great length and so on when they started taking on personal injury litigation. So I submit that...
That would be strictly a county expense as opposed to state expense, since the county court bill would not even show up in the bill analysis, would it?
All right, I'm sorry. That's true. But it was not mentioned in the bill analysis that this was going to take from the district courts and give to the probate courts any jurisdiction. It never apparently crossed their minds. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Dr. Joseph David Allen, as petitioners here. This case is one involving a landlord-tenant dispute. My client, Dr. David Dow, abandoned his leasehold and suit proceeded by the respondents to collect outstanding rent. A jury trial ensued, and the jury found in favor of Dr. David Dow, indicated that Dr. David Dow did not have any obligation to pay past due rent, indicated that the landlords were guilty of a material breach, were guilty of breaching warranties, and entered damages in favor of Dr. David. The Court of Appeals reversed and granted. We stand before this court urging four independent grounds wherein the trial court's judgment should in all things be sustained, and why this court ought to reverse the Court of Appeals. First, the jury's finding of a material breach of a lease excuses the tenant's requirements to pay his rent. Second, the finding of a constructive eviction excuses the tenant's obligation to pay rent after he has left the leasehold. Third, the jury's finding of a breach of warranty that the premises were fit for one particular purpose excuses the tenant's obligation to pay his rent. And fourth, the implied warranty of suitability or habitability for a particular purpose, a cause of action which we are here urging this court to adopt anew, excuses the obligation to pay rent. I shall deal with the issues of material breach and the implied warranty of habitability or suitability for particular purposes in a commercial setting. Mr. Mitchell will deal with the arguments concerning constructive eviction and the misrepresentations and breaches of warranty. Dr. David Dow was recruited to come to Houston, among many other doctors. He came to Houston and set up his office practice and was urged to go into this particular office building. He was the only office suitable for medical offices in the area where they had erected a new hospital. Dr. David Dow moved in while the project was still under construction. And in the ordinary course of things, problems developed. He thought that those problems would be rectified as they were able to work out the kinks, but those kinks, gentlemen, were never worked out, not even close. Instead, the problems lingered and festered. It got to the point that Dr. David Dow did not have air conditioning at his leasehold, to the point that in the summer he would literally have to sweat on top of his patients as he leaned over them. He did not have hot water at any point in time during the period of time that he was officing in this building. He had problems with mice and roaches and spiders. The roof leaked, and the roof leaked in the corner of his the lobby area of his offices, such that there were two chairs that patients just couldn't ever sit in, because if they did, they'd get wet. Now that roof leak resulted in mildew, because the carpet got rotted, and this mildew, the stench of the mildew, permeated his entire office 100% of the time. And of course, it was a little bit worse and a little bit gamier in the summertime, especially considering the fact that they didn't have air conditioning that was capable of getting anything lower than 85 degrees in the middle of the summer. In addition, they had problems with maintenance. They had problems with their hallway. Puddles formed in their hallway. They didn't have lights in their hallway. Their parking lot was virtually, they renamed it Lake Inwood because there was 6 to 8 inches worth of water that accumulated in their parking lot. They had such bad security problems that Dr. David Dow was burglarized a couple of times. One time when the vandals turned on the water, not hot water, but turned on the water and flooded his entire lease space. Other tenants in the place had to buy back their stolen goods from their own security people. In short, the conditions of the leasehold were a little bit less than desirable. In fact, they were so much less than desirable that Dr. David Dow was not able to effectively enjoy these lease premises as being suitable for a medical office. And that's what the jury so found. Dr. David Dow and a series of the other tenants got together and they decided that we have this big problem here. We can't stay here, but there isn't any other lease space in this general vicinity where our patients are. And they got together and they went to form their own group in order to buy some land and to erect a building that they were going to move in. This group included many of the tenants and many of the people that now constitute the respondents, the now owners of Inwood 2. However, they had problems with the architect, they had problems getting this thing built, and several of the now respondents, owners of Inwood, were defaulted in this deal with Dr. David M. Once it became clear they were defaulted in the deal, and then Dr. David Dow and the others sold this land at a significant profit and to the detriment of these others. Dr. David Dow, once he sold this land and once it was clear that they were not going to be able to build this new office building, finally was able to find other lease space suitable for him in that area, and he moved. And at the behest of the defaulted new owners of Inwood 2, he was sued. He was sued despite the fact that several other tenants, not doctors, but other tenants, had moved out with impunity. Suit was brought, and we tried this case to a jury, and the jury found that there was a material breach of the obligations contained within the lease. They found that the lease intimated and specified that such things as air conditioning and hot water and maintenance and all those other things that one would ordinarily expect in a commercial setting would be appropriate. Respondent describes these things as inconveniences, describes these problems as making Dr. David Dow uncomfortable, and points out the fact that Dr. David Dow did indeed remain at these lease premises, existing under these adverse circumstances, for some period of time, the reasons of which I just explained. Dr. David Dow explained to the jury that he could practice medicine out of the trunk of his car if he had to, but that isn't why he rents office space. He rents office space so that he can practice medicine in such a manner as would be attractive to his patients, and comfortable for them as well. 100% of the time, from the moment that Dr. David I moved in until the time that he left, he did not have a lease base as was represented to him or a lease base that he bargained for. Following the jury's verdict, there was a discussion and between the then plaintiff's counsel and us about the need to plead constructive eviction. We concluded with the trial court. The trial court said, well, if constructive eviction is so important, all of these matters have been raised completely. We would not change any of the evidence. And the trial court entered a trial amendment permitting the permitting us to plead constructive eviction and holding as a matter of law that the facts before the court at that time indicated that Dr. David Dow was constructively evicted. I'm skipping over also the critical point of the objections to the charge. The issues, as I indicated, were material breach, warranted. Petitioner and respondents here did not object to in any way as to the propriety of the material breach issue as being a correct statement of the law, and they did not object as to grounds of pleadings or anything of that nature. Instead, they objected only saying that we had no evidence or insufficient evidence to support such a conclusion. But the Court of Appeals, Chief Justice Brown, in dissent, reversed and rendered this case. We've brought this case to this court, hoping to correct the many errors of the Court of Appeals. First, dealing with the matter of material breach. The Court of Appeals' opinion, if we are to take it to its logical extension, essentially means that any landlord is permitted to materially breach his lease, the lease that he has with his tenant, so long, as respondent says, so long as he is not constructively evicted, so long as he isn't forced to abandon the premises. But he can materially breach those premises and get away with them because the independent covenant to pay rent will still require the payment of that rent. Respondent says, well, no, that's not right. The problem with the petitioner's argument here is that there just wasn't enough evidence, that there wasn't enough evidence that the individuals, that Dr. David Al was completely taken out of the lease space such that he couldn't enjoy it. But that's not the question. The question is whether or not Dr. David Dow was able to enjoy the lease space as it was represented, and whether or not Dr. David Dow got the lease space that he was supposed to have. He did not, not even close. And if this notion that a landlord is capable of breaching his lease with impunity, as the Court of Appeals seems to suggest, is accurate, then the Court of Appeals is bringing us straight out of the 20th century and back to those times when the peasant had no recourse against the lord of the manor. That's not 20th century jurisprudence, and this court needs to correct it. But even if that isn't a correct statement of the law, the original case, England, respondents here, waived the argument because the material breach issue was submitted, and it was submitted without objection as to the legal grounds. And the failure to object on legal grounds as to this issue concerning waiver and this issue concerning material breach necessarily constitutes waiver. The Court of Appeals reversed and rendered on a ground of purported error that was not in any way preserved. The independent covenant argument which respondents raised deals specifically with whether or not, despite all of these facts, despite all of the problems that the tenant has, whether or not they still have to pay rent. And there are a whole series of cases that say that they do. But there's an important distinction in all those cases. Each of those cases are cases where the tenant remained in possession, where he stayed there. And that makes sense. If the tenant is still there, he ought to be paying rent. If it's so bad, otherwise he should leave. That is the fundamental distinction, which is ignored by the Court of Appeals, and which respondent in his brief ignores so much that he actually omits it from quotations in the case that he cites in Mitchell versus White. Since Dr. David Dow did not remain in possession, this independent covenant to pay rent, especially in light of the other circumstances, does not exist, and his performance ought to be excused. Now, the Court of Appeals also relies very heavily on the case of Edwards versus Ward Associates. That case is likewise very distinguishable. First and foremost, that lease did not require of the landlord any obligation at all to repair the premises. There's no question that in this case they had that obligation. That case also was one where the court said that there was no evidence before them of a failure to repair the leasehold. But there's lots of evidence, plenty of evidence in this case. The Court of Appeals, in their argument, in their opinion pertaining to the material breach, and again, I can steal some of Mr. Mitchell's time, but it indicates that the evidence before them isn't enough to constitute a material breach. This opinion of the Court of Appeals, if that is accurate, if there isn't enough evidence, they just plain have not followed the requirements of Poole versus Ford. The requirements of Poole versus Ford indicate that they have to completely lay out how the facts are such that there is no factual support, that there's insufficient evidence, and the Court of Appeals just plain didn't do it. If it's a no evidence point, well, they're wrong, because there's plenty of evidence, and the jury so found. Consequently, the Court of Appeals needs to be reversed. Now, on the issue of the implied warranty, say one thing. This is the issue that the court had the opportunity to recognize a new cause of action. This court, several years ago, recognized an implied warranty of patentability in the Tamarack case in residences and residential leaseholds. There is no policy reason to distinguish the two. Absolutely none. And the respondent cannot give you any. We urge this court to recognize in cases just like this, in a commercial setting, that there is likewise an implied warranty of suitability for a particular purpose.
Brown submits just extending Camrath to this situation.
Absolutely. Yes, sir. Mr. Mitchell will handle the rest of it.
Would you put any limitations on that, or would every commercial tenant have the same rights as an individual tenant would have?
I think that they ought to. I don't know. The only distinction is policy distinction is that a commercial tenant may have some clout that an individual does not.
Or some expertise. We're talking about a worldwide corporation renting some space in a strip shopping center. They may have more expertise in bargaining, but you would not purport to. I mean, once this is extended, it ought to be extended all the way. So.
Yes, sir. I can't think of a logical reason to make that decision. Thank you.
Police court. I'd like to just briefly pick up on the implied warranty of habitability argument that Mr. Eggers has been discussing, and then hopefully get to the second two arguments, or the third and fourth reasons as to why a judgment that the trial court reached in this case is justified. Justice Phillips and Justice Kilgarland have noted and ask some questions about the Camerat decision and the implied warranty of habitability. I can speak to that question for just a moment. There is no public policy reason to reject such a theory. and no public policy reason for rejecting such a theory is either articulated in the Court of Appeals opinion nor in respondent's brief. To the contrary, there are several public policy reasons for recognizing such an implied warranty. First, the landlord is in the best position to deal with his premises. Secondly, if the landlord is aware of such an implied warranty of habitability or suitability as applied to commercial lease space, the landlord has an incentive to improve premises and property, and that benefits the public. I direct the court's attention specifically to the case Clapham versus Barnett, which is a Florida decision which discusses the specific implied warranty and points out the public policy reasons for it. Other decisions from other jurisdictions that recognize that warranty pointed out to the court in the briefs before the court.
You cited cases from four states. Is that how many states have this?
That is correct. My understanding is that there are four states that have actually recognized the warranty, but that does not imply, of course, that there are 46 states that have rejected it. The truth of the matter is that the issue simply hasn't come up all that often. The majority of states that have actually considered the warranty seem to be recognizing that as a proper theory, proper defensive theory, or a proper cause of action under certain circumstances.
Have any states rejected the theory?
It is possible that a New York Court of Appeals opinion, I do not recall the site, I believe that it is discussed in our brief, has rejected the theory.
Mr. Mitchell, do we need to reach that? Do we have a proved case?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Justice Robertson, as our brief makes clear, that is just one of four separate and independent defensive arguments, three of which are already supported by Texas law. One, Mr. Akers has already discussed, the material breach issue. The second...
I have one more question on the new implied warranty before you leave it. How many states have a CAMRAT type warranty? Is that the overwhelming majority of the states?
I believe so, Your Honor. I think when we researched that issue, it has been several months. We turned up something like 26 or 27 states that have recognized an implied warranty of habitability for residential leasehold estates. I don't remember the exact number, it's been a few months, but I believe it has been a majority of the states in this country. To return to the final arguments to be discussed in our argument today, and that is the issue of constructive eviction and the issue of express warranty. Those are defensive issues that we contend are supported by the pleadings, are supported by the evidence, and are supported by the special issues. First, with regard to constructive eviction, the Court of Appeals noted on the theory of constructive eviction that that was the only defense that the tenant had in this case. Now, of course, we don't agree with that. We believe that material breach and express warranty also constitute defenses. But even assuming that constructive eviction is the only defense in a case such as this, let us examine what the Court of Appeals has done with that issue. The Court of Appeals noted that it was not supported by the pleadings, was not supported by the evidence, and was not supported by the special issues. To begin with, the pleadings. The pleadings in this case, which are set out in Exhibit B to our brief, the pleadings state that the lease was materially breached and hence was null and void. And we contend that that is a sufficient enough general allegation. But at any rate, there were no special exceptions to our pleadings. No special exceptions at all. And it is our contention under Rule 90 and the other rules of the Texas Civil Procedure that any sort of complaint as to pleadings was waived when there was no special exceptions. Second, the evidence. Mr. Akers discussed that evidence, and that evidence makes clear that there was, in fact, a constructive eviction. Constructive eviction is defined under the law as an intentional act by the landlord to deprive the tenant of part of or a substantial part of his premises such that the tenant abandons those premises. And I think all the evidence to support that defensive theory is available. Thirdly, with respect to the issue, and I might add, just as respondent did not specially accept to our pleadings, he did not object to any of the evidence that came in at the trial court on the basis that that evidence proved up an improper defensive theory or a defensive theory that was not properly pled for. Finally, with respect to the issue, we contend that material breach is a broad submission that includes within its confines an independent ground of recovery or defense, that being constructive eviction. And because respondent again did not object to the special issue on the ground that it was the impermissible legal theory, or that it was not supported by the pleadings, or that it was an impermissible broad issue, because none of those objections were made, we contend that he waived any error. But at any rate, under the decisions of Island Recreation, decision that this court is familiar with and handed down in 1986, and the case of Bill versus Meeks, which is a case written by Justice Ray in 1987, it is our contention that construction eviction was, in fact, tried by consent. For example, in Bell v. Meeks, as the court might recall, plaintiff had originally pled under the DTPA for a warranty theory, and at the time of trial, evidence came in with respect to misrepresentation. There was no objection to the evidence at that time. On the day that the issues were submitted to the jury, a plaintiff sought for a trial amendment to plead for misrepresentation. And as the court appropriately mentioned in that decision, and there was no error with respect to what the plaintiff did, it wouldn't have made any difference on how he tried his case, whether you call it material breach or constructive eviction, or in the Bell case, warranty or misrepresentation. We would have tried our case the same way. We would have put on the same evidence as what the landlord did or did not do. And therefore, we believe that Bell versus Meeks and Island Recreation support our position on constructive eviction. And I might add that the authority cited in the respondent's brief on this particular issue with regard to the trial amendment is the Court of Appeals opinion in Yell versus Piper, which of course was subsequently overruled on the specific issue cited for when I believe it was Justice Spears wrote the Supreme Court decision in Yell versus Piper. That returns us to our final argument, our final defensive theory that we believe justifies an affirmance of the trial court judgment and the jury verdict in our favor. And that is the defensive issue of express warranty. The jury found in special issues 3 and 4 that the lease space was expressly warranted to be suitable for a medical office. And in special issue number 4 found that those offices were in fact not suitable for a lease space. The Court of Appeals only had one comment on this defensive theory and pointed out that express warranty was not pled for. We believe that the pleadings read otherwise, and we also note that, as with the other issues, material breach and constructive eviction, no special exceptions were made to the pleadings. The jury found that they were not suitable for a medical office, and if a lease space is not suitable for the purpose that it is rented for, it is our contention that Texas law is, and Texas law should be, that the tenant is entitled to abandon the premises and has an absolute defense. So in conclusion, it is our contention that there are four separate and independent defensive theories, each standing on its own, that justify an affirmance of the trial court judgment and the jury verdict. Number one, that the landlord materially breached his lease. Number two, that we're entitled to a cause of action or a defense based upon the implied warranty of habitability or suitability as applied to a commercial lease space. Number three, that respondent tried the issue of constructive eviction by consent, and that if that is the only defense, that the procedural errors made by the respondent justify a decision in Dr. David Dow's favor. And finally, fourth, that the express warranty that was breached as found by the jury justifies a decision in favor of the respondent. We urge the court to find for the trial court, the jury, and Dr. David Allen. Thank you.
We'll hear argument from respondent.
Respondent is ready, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
Mr. Richard Wake will present an argument from respondent.
May it please the Court. Your Honors, I'm Richard Waits. I'm from Dallas, Houston, and I have represented the Inwood Mill Professional Group Phase 1 since the beginning of the trial was caused. I thought that I would begin by bringing to the Court's attention some facts that the petitioner has ostensibly omitted from his discussion with you this morning, and then move on to my reply to their points. It seems that the fact that Dr. David L. attorneys have brought you this morning are so important to them that they have embellished upon them since the time of trial. At trial, Dr. David L. testified very unequivocally that out of 1,340 days that he occupied this office suite, he was only not able to use it for 5 days, and that those 5 days were attributed to hurricanes or other storms causing electrical outages out in the suburbs where this building is located, not due to any fault of the Inwood Mill Professional Group. To carry that point even further, as the record before this Court demonstrates, we went through all of the services that the landlord was supposed to provide to Dr. David Al under this lease agreement and asked him, was there any problem that the landlord caused by not providing these services causing you not to be able to use your medical office? And at each one of those services, as we went through them on the board, he said no. There were no days that I was not able to use the office because of the services that the landlord was supposed to provide but didn't. As a matter of fact, Dr. David Al testified that the medical building that he was in was a very nice medical building in a very upper-class suburb of Houston, and that the proverbial roof leak that the petitioner wants to bring to your attention today was in fact just that. It was a small leak that happened whenever there was a tremendous rainstorm, which does happen sometimes in that part of the state, causing a small two-chair area to get wet on those occasions.
Mr. Wace, do you think that petitioners have over-dramatized the problem with the lease space any more than Chief Justice Brown did in his dissent?
Your Honor, I think there's an unequivocal response that's probably due on that, but let me just say that there is a tremendous amount of over-dramatization that has been brought in this case since the time of the voir dire. Chief Justice Brown had a point that he wanted to make, I believe, on broad submission, but I don't believe that he was particularly disturbed or felt that there was too much of a problem with the lease space. As a matter of fact, at trial, Dr. David Al testified that he moved into this office space in January of 1979, and at that time realized that there were some problems that weren't going to be corrected. But he also testified in the next sentence in his testimony, throughout the testimony, the transcript will show this, he did not move out until June of 1982, some 3 years and 11 months later. The most astonishing thing that I have found in the appellate process of this case is how dramatically the issues that were presented to the trial court are different from the issues that have been presented on appeal by the petitioner. I have brought with me a copy of his original answer. The petitioner stated at trial in his original answer, and we believe that these were the only issues that we were trying at that time, that he was generally denying the plaintiff's allegations against him, that he was bringing an affirmative defense that the landlord had materially breached the lease, unquote, and that he was entitled to an affirmative defense of an implied warranty that the premises were suitable for the purposes for which they were leased. Those were the only issues that we believe we were trying in this lawsuit. Now, we understand, 2 years after the case was tried, and in the brief that the petitioner had brought to the Court of Appeals and on the motion for rehearing, that we were supposedly trying the issue of constructive eviction by consent, and that we were supposedly submitting the issue of constructive eviction within the material breach issue that we didn't object to. The problem with that is, you're left sort of scratching your head. It's sort of like walking into an art gallery where they display only Southwestern Indian art, and someone walks up to you and they say, you know, they just don't have enough Oriental art in this place. And you're sort of left scratching your head thinking, you know, did I miss something? The gist of the argument that we have is presented, I'd like to present to you within 4 points, although there are 13 points of appeal that the petitioner has brought today. My first point is, a simple material breach of a lease by a landlord will not defeat an action by a landlord under an independent covenant to pay rent. My second point will be that constructive eviction was not brought to the trial court at the trial of this cause. My third point is that there is no implied warranty for commercial leases in Texas, nor should there be. My fourth point is that the defendant is not entitled to damages, which they have not discussed this morning, but they have asked for in their application for writ of error. Getting to my first point, the policy I think that we want to bring to the court's attention this morning is that if a petitioner or a litigant, any litigant, is allowed to bring issues later on appeal that he failed to bring during the trial of a cause, saying, oh, well, wait, we meant to call it that, and we didn't call it that, we called it something else, then every litigant in the state of Texas will be held up for some unfair surprise later on when it's too late to object, that they didn't, someone arguing that they didn't especially accept or object to an issue or a special issue or a pleading, when there was no idea or no indication that that defense or that issue was being raised. My second policy that I will also discuss under the implied warranty defense is that within the real estate market in the state of Texas, as most every other state, tenants are finding lots of ways to get out of leases already. And because of the lowering interest rates and so forth, it would be in the best interest, we believe, of everyone to require that basic landlord-tenant law be strictly observed. And as I will discuss in a minute, there are plenty of remedies that a tenant has under basic landlord-tenant law. Getting to my first point, simple material breach of lease by a landlord will not defeat a landlord's action under an independent covenant to pay rent. It is well under Texas landlord-tenant law, as well as that of all the other 49 states, that an independent covenant to pay rent is recoverable even if the landlord fails to repair the premises under his covenant to repair the premises. There are defenses which are allowed to a tenant under those circumstances, however. Those defenses, even under Texas law, are very clearly laid out in case after case after case, and the petitioner has not found a case otherwise. Those three defenses are constructive eviction, fraud on the part of the landlord, or mutual mistake. When those defenses are properly raised by a defendant, tenant, in a trial, they will affirmatively defeat an independent covenant to pay rent. That did not happen in this case. As a matter of fact, as is clear from the answer that we thought we were operating under from the petitioner at that time, the only defenses we thought we were having to deal with were a simple material breach of lease, an implied breach of an implied warranty of fitness for a particular purpose, neither of which have been recognized under Texas law. So to have to object that they were not legally sufficient to defeat the claim of the petitioner or the claim of the landlord was not necessary. We raised those in other motions for the trial court.
Let me see if I understand you here. You're saying that the tenant's covenant to pay rent is independent of the landlord's covenant to keep the premises in good repair.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's certainly what the 14th Court said in the opinion. What then would be the relief available to the tenant to get the landlord to keep the premises in good repair?
I'm glad you asked it, Your Honor. A tenant has a host of remedies. One that occurs off the top of my head is an injunctive remedy to require that the landlord repair something that needs to be repaired. An additional remedy, which is recognized in common law as well as the property code in the state of Texas, is a claim for damages for having to repair it himself and then having to go back and claim that the landlord should reimburse him for his damages. Those are two remedies that strike me right off.
Do you think those are feasible? Because one, you have to pay an attorney, I presume, to get you an injunction. Two, presumes that you've got the money to make the repairs yourself so that you can ask the landlord to reimburse you for the repairs you made. Are those really feasible alternatives?
They're used every day across the state of Texas, Your Honor. As a matter of fact, I believe it's well settled that whenever a litigant sues for breach of contract or breach of warranty, he has a right to recover his attorney's fees under several statutes in the state of Texas. In this particular instance, the petitioner did not bring a counterclaim for damages, which I will discuss in my fourth point. But at this time, suffice to say that as far as was apparent from the record at that time, there was no defense being brought to the court which would have defeated the independent covenant to pay rent. To further illustrate it, let me move on to my second point.
But before you do that, you mentioned that the tenant had a host of remedies, and you named two. Two doesn't even make a crowd. Can you get some more remedies that he's got available to him other than filing these lawsuits?
Under his contract, Your Honor, besides the fact that he has a remedy under common law, under the written contract, a tenant is given a remedy against the landlord there for damages if for some reason he doesn't perform. But that's the same remedy that's brought day in and day out against any party who doesn't perform under a contract. The relationship between the landlord and the tenant are both contractual relationships. It's a contractual relationship. They're both contractual parties. They have contractual remedies against each other, whether they be ancillary in the form of injunctive relief or some other ancillary relief, or as a claim for damages. But even if, for some reason...
Well, you know, tenants don't draw these leases. The landlord draws them. So they're going to make the duties, as a rule, such that the landlord has a little bit of a leverage there. What I'm suggesting to you is that the only remedy you've given a tenant who is furnished uninhabitable for business purposes, premises, is to file a lawsuit or to make the repairs himself. Doesn't even get an offset to the rent. He can sue.
Your Honor, I believe that would also be a remedy that's available. That is listed as an affirmative defense or affirmative relief. Quasi-affirmative relief situation in any contract. But quite frankly, I don't know of any other relief allowed to any party under any kind of contract breach or quasi-contract breach. Every method of relief or kind of relief available to a contractual party is available to a tenant, just like any other contract.
Like Jeremy's saying, these are big boys and they can contract at arm's length, and if they don't make the provision in the contract to remedy this kind of damage to the property, they're tough out of luck.
Your Honor, I believe that I might skip my fourth point and come back to my second point if it's all right with you. May I discuss the implied warranty of habitability request that the petitioner has today? And Camerath v. Bennett, the Supreme Court of the state of Texas decided that it was good policy that the citizens of the state of Texas should have a good place to live, that it was unfair for a landlord to take advantage of a poor, unsuspecting tenant who had no equal bargaining power, didn't know what they were looking for, didn't know what to look out for, and yet tied them into a lease agreement. That's good policy. We don't disagree with that. For two reasons, that policy should not be applied in this situation. The first one is based on the facts. Dr. David Al testified at trial that he occupied this medical suite several months prior to entering into this lease agreement. He knew what he was getting into. Secondly, there are lots of medical offices available in Houston, Texas. He could have gone anywhere. He's a bright fellow. He graduated from one of the top medical schools in the state, in the country of Canada. And he had plenty of bargaining power. And if you were to meet Dr. David Al, he's quite savvy. He knows exactly what's going on. To apply an implied warranty of habitability in a situation like this is not appropriate. For that reason, for those two reasons. I might also state, regarding the cases that the petitioner cited, the three or four states which have considered this issue of an implied warranty don't call it an implied warranty of habitability, as I understand it. Obviously, an office is not a habitation. But there are some implied warranties as to the fact that a place is tenable, that it is occupiable. But as far as what goes into that space, that's up to the parties to contract out. They're big boys. They can decide for themselves. They're experienced business people. Or they can go out and get themselves a lawyer. We talk to prospective tenants day in and day out and counsel with them about what they should include in their lease agreements with their landlords. So for those reasons, an implied warranty in the state of Texas would not be appropriate. I might also say that the New York Court of Appeals that rejected the argument found that their New York business people were quite savvy. They didn't need an implied of tenability or habitability to protect them. They felt that they could enter into contracts and enforce their own contracts. With that, I'd like to move back to my second point regarding the issue that the petitioner says was tried by consent.